Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 291, my conversation with poet and improviser Shweta Bhatt. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts. You know, I bet you could even gift an Audible subscription to a friend of yours for Christmas. Also, you want to buy a book for your mom, but you're not sure what it's about. Maybe you should listen to a little bit of it on Audible before you send it to her, in case it's particularly racy or, I don't know, represents the opposite political party than she is. You never know. It's helpful. Audible's what you need in your life. Also, of course, I don't know if you know this, but like once you have your account and you're using it and it's amazing, you can also use the Audible app to listen to Yes But Why podcast. Easy, everything in one place. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your account today. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by podcastcadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. Connect with us, and if we have the resources to help you, we absolutely will. And if we don't have the time or ability to do it, we will connect you with the people that can, because we just want podcasting to be easier for everyone. And that's what Podcast Cadet is all about. Now, we have put a bunch of things on the website already at podcastcadet.com that can really help you, videos and various other things. But no matter what it is that you need, whether you need us to help you do some editing on your podcast or you want to take a workshop to figure out, you know, what am I supposed to do with my podcast? How do I write a script? Stuff like that. We can help. Mention code YBY20 to get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by TrueHempScience.com. True Hemp Science is our resource for vegan-friendly whole plant extract CBD oil. You know, there's a lot of CBD out there now. Everyone's trying to sell it as this miracle drug. Oh, take it. You're going to be totally calm. For me, it's not about like taking a tincture and getting calm, but there is something about the lotions for me. When it goes into my skin, it's like, you know, it's almost like when you get like a steroid. It's not a steroid, but it's like it soothes you in that way on your skin. You know, it really helps in that way. So, you know, CBD is for different people for different things. It helps people in their own way, but you know, it's out there and people are really getting some great relief from it. So check it out. Go to TrueHempScience.com just to see all the CBD products that are available. And if you decide to buy, you can use code YESBUTY7 and get 7% off your order of $50 or more. And if you put in the code, they will send you a free packet of CBD edibles with your order. So fun. So yummy. TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why, I had a great chat with Shweta Bhatt, theater artist, improviser, and poet based out of Bangalore, India. Listen in as we talk about storytelling, stage fright, and the sanctity of alone time. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 291, Shweta Bhatt on appreciating the art that you create. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah. The first thing that I like to talk about in our podcast episodes is about childhood. What was the way that you were creative as a child? How did you play?
Well, What stands out for me as I'm thinking about it is that as a child, I had trouble making friends. I remember up until the age of 5, I did sort of make some friends, and then we moved from one part of Bangalore to another part of Bangalore. But it was almost like moving to another world for me. I feel like we also moved a little bit up the economic ladder. So it was a different, I wouldn't say class, but like a whole another group of people, our neighbors and you know their kids. And then I had so much trouble just socializing that I very quickly gave up on it. I was like, I don't know how to go and approach that girl and say, hi, do you want to play together? And she isn't approaching me. So then I think I sort of learned very quickly to just play by myself. So I relied on my imagination a lot. Mm. I love to sort of role play little scenarios where I was the hero, I was the villain, I was the court jester, everybody. And I was quite okay with it. I mean, the only time I felt like there was something wrong with that is when I think the older people, like my parents and my teachers, sort of pointed out that, oh, you don't seem to have friends. You should learn to mingle. But then fairly, by and large, I was quite happy by myself because I had not one, not two, but like a whole group of imaginary friends as I was growing up. And by and large, I did not really see the need to go out of my way to make friends, which also sort of limited me in my childhood in terms of social, just gave me a lot of social anxiety. Huh. But at the same time, I think my imagination was just, I think, worked on so much that I just had fun. I remember those times when I used to role play and just dream up these stories in my head. I was gone. I mean, I was just in my own world. Yeah. And that is one thing that really stands out for me in my childhood.
Yeah. Man, it's totally weird. I'm thinking about what you're saying with reference to the fact that now I'm a parent and like this idea that like we put on our kids this idea of like what you should do and what you should be. Mm-hmm. And that's so hard, you know, because every person it should be allowed to just live their life the way that they feel comfortable. Right. And I love the mm-hmm. idea that you embraced how beautiful it was that you could tell all these stories in your brain, but that it still gave you anxiety because everyone around you is all like, hey, what are you doing? That's not the right way to do things. And you're like, wait, it feels right to me. What do you mean it's not right? Like, it's so yeah. hard that those kinds of rules exist that, you know, we feel like we have to. And like, I understand from the point of view of the parent, like, you know, you're just trying to get them ready for the real world. You know, you've got to live in it. So you've got to figure out how to get over not talking to people. Like, yeah, everyone's super weird. You just got to keep talking to them. It's something wonderful that you had, like, and that you still have this ability to imagine full stories and all the characters and everybody's point of view. It's almost like what I was talking to you about earlier, like, our yeah. creative brains really do have the ability to know truly and understand each person and their different perspective within the story, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And also, to their credit, my parents tried, and I think now I can understand their concern that they were just trying to sort of as you said, just prepare me for the real world. And the real world requires social interactions. And I'm really grateful that as an adult, I picked up on so interacting socially. I know how to people. I can people when it is required.
So, you can people now. But, good, good.
But I do feel like I think there's a lot of emphasis placed on socializing, which is good, but I guess in a way it also ends up devaluing solitary the solitariness of childhood, which I suspect a lot of children sort of experience.
Yeah.
So for me, I think in my childhood, what bothered me was not so much that my parents were urging me to mingle, but I think the way that they were going about it, sometimes my teachers, you know, would express their worry that, you know, oh my God, you're by yourself during games period. You're just sitting by yourself and you're like doing your own thing. Oh my God. And then I would think, oh my God, what is wrong with me?
Yeah.
You know, there must be something.
Yeah, they put that in your brain, though. They like created that. Like there was nothing wrong with it. And you know, yeah. To your point, there is sort of a negativity in culture about aloneness. But I wish that we could embrace it because so much of our lives we are alone. And I think that there is this epidemic of loneliness that people feel, especially like in their 20s when they first leave, when they like move away from their parents or whatever, or they move to somewhere else for like a job or something and they're by themselves, as opposed to being able to truly embrace like, oh, great, I get some alone time now. I get to really, you know, focus on who I am at this point. There's this stigma like that says, if you don't have a bunch of friends, like I was just thinking it the other day, like I don't have a ton of friends that I talk to every day or that like comes over for dinner, right? Like we just don't. That's just not how I'm more of a worker bee. I do little things. I clearly have a large social media, you know, pal group. So I'm like, yeah, I'm good. I was like, I talked to 45 people today. They were all over the world. I don't know who else I got to talk to. Like, it's like, I talked to my husband. I talked to my child. I talked to 45 improvisers about food. I mean, I'm good. You know, like if I had other friends, I'd be like, yeah, don't come over. It's fine. I'm full up, you know, but there's this thing that makes you feel like if you don't do it this one way, you're not doing it right. And I'm like, who's making these rules? And why are they enforcing them with to the detriment of anyone who is confident and has the calmness enough to be alone? I mean, it's such a skill.
Yeah, absolutely. Something very funny that I remember now is that in the fifth grade, I don't know how it happened. I still don't know. But all of a sudden in the fifth grade, due to some circumstances, I was part of the popular girls group all of a sudden. And I was popular for like a whole, like almost half of a 3/4 of the grade for the year. And then it went away as suddenly as it came on. And I still, as an adult, I'm not able to figure out what led to it. And in sixth grade, I was back to being on my own. You know, I don't know what happened, but it was a very strange year.
You know, I always like to think that, and of course, this is probably my own coping mechanism, but like, I like to think that, you know, when things like that happen, all those popular girls are very self-conscious, right? And they probably saw some confidence in you that they were like, maybe we can suck that out of her. Let's bring her over and she'll show us how to be confident because that's what she's doing just naturally all day. And I want some of that, right? And every time in my life that I've felt like, why are these people being nice to me? Like later on when I speak to them, you know, like in my 20s, I meet some people and then I talk to them recently and, oh, hey, you know, and then you find out, oh, no, you just seemed so together. And it's like, I did. I was not together. I don't think I've ever been together, but I appreciate you thought so, you know, and I feel like that's what happens. Like fifth grade also is like a big time for like, it's like the moment when I think about when I teach improv, I always talk to my students about how we are naturally, as children, we naturally know how to play. But then once puberty hits in and all the hormones start filling us, we lose it. It's like the hormones take the place of the play. The play had all this open space in you, and then the hormones were like, and it's like, oh, sorry, no more room for play. You better feel bad about yourself now. And so that's what happens. And I think that fifth grade is kind of that spot, right?
Yeah.
And I say that only because I've, in this last couple of years, I've taught a lot of children at different age levels. Like a lot of my work has been Zoom improv with kids. And I've taught like 8-year-olds, 12-year-olds, and then 16-year-olds, right? And I always notice the difference between the way they process creativity, right? 8-year-olds, they got it. Doesn't matter what. You're all like, here's a banana. You're going to marry it. Go. And then they've got like a 20-minute scene, and they're all like, oh, yeah, it's a banana, and I'm going to go to Cabo. And, you know, like they've got a whole story in their brain. They have no judgment. There's nothing. Middle school, they want to make like blue jokes, like they love making farting jokes and they love making jokes that they think you're going to get offended. After teaching comedy for so many years, I'm like, listen, guys, nothing that you say is going to offend me. But let's be clear, the people watching this show that we're writing are your parents. So they are. And let's not write that joke about poop. I mean, it's hilarious. Don't get me wrong. You're great. But maybe not so many fart jokes. But then once you get like the high school students, they get really like serious. Like they're like, okay, but like, how could it save the world? Like, how could we write this sketch where like at the end, people are like, I totally understand why climate change is a real thing. And I'm like, guys, okay, let's get into it. You know, like they're ready for politics all of a sudden. So I think that it's just like different places that your brain is and like different, you know, moments in your life when you suddenly see the world in a different way, you know, and, you know, fifth grade, that's key. I think that's key. They were seeking out the coolest person. They found you. And then they, like I said, they sucked all the cool stuff. And then they were like, let's go. And they took off. And it was like, what? And you remained cool. So they were like, all right, no harm, no foul.
Well, that might actually be true. That might be true. I look back at myself now and I'm like, I was pretty cool.
Yeah.
The world did not know it yet, but there I was. And yeah, absolutely.
Oh man. God. So as you got older and you have this natural ability to tell stories, you have this, you know, lock on how to, you know, be masterfully alone and like take care of yourself. At what point did you get involved with, because like right now you do storytelling and you do performance on stage. How did Shy Gal end up on stage?
Oh, yeah. Well, the first time I was on stage, so I've been on stage on and off ever since my childhood. So the very first play I did was actually when I was like 4 years old or 5 years old. And it was some Snow White or some, either it was Snow White or it was Cinderella. I don't remember which, but I have a picture wherein I'm, you know, wearing this long white dress and throwing roses or whatever it is.
Nice.
So I have been on stage, but I think I developed stage fright, which was really almost debilitating stage fright in my, you know, around that time of probably 8, 9, 10, you know, around that time. And I remember I forced myself to take part in this elocution competition in grade 5, actually, fifth grade, because I was thinking, you know, I need to do something. Everybody else is so social and everybody tells me I need to like take part in things and I need to like do this. And I remember it was an agonizing experience and I didn't prepare well. I went on stage, I mumbled something, and it's such a catch-22, you know, when you're not doing well and then the audience reaction is a reflection of what you're thinking. And it just like gets bigger and bigger. That's what happened to me then. And I almost quit. I was like, I'm never going up. I'm never going to talk to a group of people again. But thankfully, I think the next year, my father is a natural storyteller. And like, he is so good at it. He's amazing on stage. So he sort of helped me out for the next year. So on and off in elocution or in some sort of a bit part in a small play, I have been part of the stage in some part or another. But I think as an adult, as a very fully grown adult, I sort of intentionally stepped onto the stage in the sense of going, you know, stepping into theater, basically happened. That happened as an adult. In fact, that happened in my 30s almost. So my whole childhood and my 20s were by and large sort of running away from the limelight or running away from just being seen, being comfortable with being seen. In my 30s, I think I was looking, I had a vague feeling that I would enjoy it, but I felt like I was not giving myself the push required to sort of, you know, enjoy it, to actually, you know, take joy from it. So I enrolled myself in theater classes, and I have not looked back since. Now, I think my day job involves talking to a group, like groups of people, which is almost like a, you know, like being on stage. My evening work, which is improv or storytelling or poetry performances, involves stage work. So yeah, now my entire life is practically on stage or very much near it.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. You know, it's funny because they like to talk about what 20-somethings want to do, and that seems mm-hmm. to be what everyone wants to focus on culturally. Like, it's like, oh, this is the cool thing. But I, too, felt like I got to, like, a more comfortable with myself place in my 30s. And it was like, I finally, like, I tell people that, like, I didn't realize how amped, how, like, nervous and excited I was in my 20s until I got a little bit older. And then I was like, oh, wow, I am way calmer now. Like, I am not as – nothing is as intense and dire. Like, every situation isn't like, this is the end of the world. Like, so, you know, it's not like we're – you know, I'm not sure how – we develop it or if it's just a natural, maybe it's like another one of those hormone things where it's like the hormones in our body change a little bit and maybe it releases a little bit of that like deep worry, or like you've been alive long enough to be like, hey, there've been some ups and downs, but mostly ups, yeah. You know, because I feel like people in their 30s either are like, yeah, I'm feeling good about this, or they're like, nah, I'm done. That's it. Everything's been terrible. Yeah. It's going to be continue to be terrible. And you're like, okay, well, I know what you've gone through, so I can't argue with you. But, you know, possibly there's other hope given that you're likely to be alive for 50 plus more years. So
yeah.
Keep hope in there.
I think it's also for me, it is also, I look at it as also partially cultural mm-hmm. because there's a lot of negative messages attached to becoming 30. And yes. It is gendered in the sense that, you know, women are sort of also, I think, affected more by it, by the messages. And I had also internalized those messages. So I was, in my head, once you turn 30, you become boring. That is legit how I thought about it in my 20s. You know, I just, okay, I'm going to just become this boring person. But then how was it possible that the person I was in my 20s would suddenly become this completely other person in my 30s, who's so like, you know, but then I didn't, that was what I felt like the world was telling me. So here's what I did. I was so anxious about turning 30, being in my 30s, especially as a woman in India, especially as a woman who is unmarried in India, because there's a certain connotation to unmarried women, older women in their 30s, that I... So what I do is, we were talking about how you make art that you need, that gives you joy or that affects you. So that was what I was doing with my poetry at that point of time. So I wrote a poem called When I Turned 30. And I, you know, I just added all the wonderful things that happened when I turned 30, which nobody talks about. For example, what you said, you know, I think you feel much more grounded and calmer. For me, I felt like I was much more assertive and sure of myself. And so that allowed me, and also because nobody, I think expectations from society sort of come down, in that age for women. So I was free to explore what me being in my 30s will look like or looks like, without sort of having that thing of what am I supposed to do now, right? I think that happens. I think in your career or your day job, as opposed to your 20s, 30s, maybe you might be in a sort of a more stabler position, to for the lack of a better word.
Yeah.
So many things happen. And I, when I wrote them down, I was like, okay. And now 30s are, I wouldn't go back to my 20s for anything, really. I mean, I feel like I'm having so much fun
yeah.
in my 30s that I'm like, okay.
Yeah, totally. I was just saying to my husband yesterday that, like, I feel like there's, like, the theory that, you know, old soul, young soul. You meet somebody and they're, like, 8, but they've got, like, an old soul. And they're like, oh, she's 8 going on 48. And they, like, because they sort of act a certain way. I kind of believe that. Like, I think that inside we are a certain age. And then when we get there, we finally feel comfortable. And for me, that age was 36. Like, when I got to 36, I was like, yeah, this is me. This is what I've been my whole life. When I was 5 years old entertaining, you know, people at my parents' dinner parties, I was 36-year-old me. Like, and because they'd always be like, how are you so mature? You're 5. And I was like, I'm cool. But now, so I'm older than 36 now. I'm 43. And I feel younger. Like, so I talk to my friends. We're all in our 40s, blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, Nah, I'm 36. Like, that's who I am inside, right? So as I get older, so even when I'm 70, I'm gonna be like, nah, it's cool. I got it. I'm kicky. You know what I mean? Like, I'll still have sort of, because that's where I felt the most comfortable. And now, like, I'm having a good time. Don't get me wrong. 40s are good. 40s are good. I've heard from friends that 50s are also good. So, you know, hope for the future. But, like, I feel like I'm solid. Like, that's where I felt the most secure. And I'm just going to maintain that, like, you know, self-assurance from when I was 36 all the way through. And that will buoy me. And then, you know, then I'm not like 100 years old. And there's totally, like, have you ever met somebody who's like total, like my child is like 80. Like, he is an 80-year-old man. He's 4.
Oh, yes.
But he's an 80-year-old man. He goes up to groups of adults. He leans down, puts his hands on his knees and goes, hi, kids. Like, why does he look at these adults and think they are kids, right? You know, it's just the way he is. And I'm like, no, I'm raising like an 80-year-old man. Like, that's what's going on. He does things like he goes around the house and shuts all the doors. Like, he'll tell us when the lights have been on too long. Mom, we should turn that light off. You know, we're not really using it. Well, you're right. Like, he's hilarious. You know what I mean? Like, things that I'm like, a 4-year-old should not be trying to help us keep the doors closed. And like, oh, you forgot to lock that lock. I'm like, oh, I did. Okay, thanks. Like, what?
You know, my God.
The people are who they are. Yeah. I mean, you know, we are who we are. And I think the sooner we kind of like embrace our own self, like to the point where I love that you came to the stage in your 30s, but I truly believe that all of the solo work that you did prior to that was necessary for you to be able to write what you write, for you to be able to tell the stories that you tell, like for you to even be able to process, you know, creating theater with your friends that you do now, you had all this work that you put in. Like, you know, as a child, you naturally developed the storytelling part of your brain. And clearly it was genetic since dad's a natural storyteller, but like, you know, you had it in you. You were just sort of like building the groundwork and you're like, listen, I got enough material now. I'm ready to reveal it. Like,
yeah. Oh my God. I did see it that way. That's such a nice way to see it.
I mean, I truly, we are, talking about you telling the stories to yourself, playing role play in your head. It's,
it's storytelling. I mean, it's like you're writing novels as you're chatting, right? I hear my kid do it too. He's in the back seat all the time playing every part. And like my husband will go to respond to him and I'm like, he's not talking to us. He's doing a full scene and he's playing every character. Let him do it, right? And, yeah. And you know, he'll have conversations and he sometimes the characters like stuff, sometimes they don't. Like if, you know, that's just what we do when we allow our brain to tell the full stories, yeah. Right? I mean, novel yeah. writers write 1,000 characters, right? They create this whole world and they know what the hero feels, what the villain feels. They're like involved with that. That's a superhero yeah. skill. And you had yeah. that. And it was really just getting over the hump of the cultural issues that are between you and the stage, yeah. you know, to get there.
I think also having the freedom to sort of do it as play for myself when I was younger, because I didn't do it with the view of, I'm going to get on stage or I'm going to impress my teachers or, you know, those yeah. stories never went anywhere. They never went out of my head. In fact, I didn't even write a lot of them down. I think that kind of freedom sort of also helped me because I learned. So one of the biggest sort of fundamentals of my life is if I create something, I should like it because I'm my first and sometimes only audience. And if I like it, then nothing else matters. And if I don't like it, then chances are very likely that it won't really hit for anybody else either. So yeah, I think the initial experience of just doing it for myself really, really helped. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah. And as well, you should be the only person it really matters to. That's the other part is that like a lot of us are beholden to our ego or beholden to like the audience and like what they think. You know, I've definitely mm-hmm. had produced a number of shows where at the end, you know, the audience didn't love it, but me and the other performers had a great time. And I have to go back to them and say like, guys, we should not feel bad. Yeah. Those 40 people that were in the audience weren't with us, but we came up with a great story. We had a fun time. We really enjoyed putting it out there. It's as good. Like, yes, I get that we're an audience-pleasing sort of world, but, you know, not really. You know, like you said, you are your own number one critic, number one audience member. If you like it, it's good, you know?
Yeah.
It's yeah. really just about yeah. finding the people that are your people. And then they're like, I love what you're doing, man, because I thought of that too. And you're like, yeah, right?
Which I think some days I'm more like receptive to those external messages because I think as a society, we are very, as you said, audience pleasing structures that are set up. So some days it's easier said than done. I agree. Like there have been some shows which have not gone so well after which I'm like, oh no, why do I subject myself to this theater? No. But some days I do not care if one single person says, oh, that was good.
Yeah.
That also actually like, you know, that is a icing on the cake, but the cake will be that, oh, I was having so much fun making up things in the moment or just being on stage and doing my thing. And then after that, I'm going to like celebrate by just getting myself some good food, whatever it is, you know? Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the difference between art and business. Like yep. art is the creation of a thing. It's good or bad. It doesn't actually matter. Some people like it. Some people don't. And then there's yeah. business. How do you sell that art? How do you get people, how do you get butts in seats? How do you convince people to pay you money for doing that thing? I mean, it like, I'm just thinking right now of like Banksy, for instance, makes art, is a created a lore about themselves and then creates art that like now goes for like billions of dollars because they created this thing, waited until finally people joined. Because for a long time, it was just like random stuff. Remember, it was like, oh, yeah, there's a wall that got this weird mural put on it and it says Banksy. And it's like, who's that? And then like 2 years ago, there's like, they're like selling, you know, their paintings at auction for like, oh, 16 million. It's not a big deal. And you're like, what? Like, are you kidding? But that person, the person who does the art, was an artist from the first painting that everyone was like, that's dumb, all the way through the one they paid $1 million for. It's just the difference between art and business, like, and also cultural, like, connection to stuff. Like, we're talking about a lot of stuff that you and I do similarly is improv. And now, don't get me wrong, I'm pretty sure the improv that you're doing and the improv that I'm doing is different because it's there's different styles across the world. But, you know, we have this, the excitement on improv is new, right? Improv's been around for a long, 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 long time. I mean, you know, some could argue that it was well before John Stone and Spolin had these cool books and told everybody. And then they were like, have you seen this book? We should totally do these games. But it existed well before they wrote it down. But they are just kind of our... they're like our Shakespeare. They're like the people who like told us, oh my God, I can do that? Okay, great. They like gave us the permission to do it.
Permission.
But
yes,
people have been doing this. I mean, from things like Commedia dell'arte, the style of Italian plays where they had stock characters and they would play it, which is, it's sort of similar to like things like D&D, like Dungeons and Dragons, where it's like, there's a specific character. When you're assigned that character, you know, like what about yourself, you know, that kind of stuff. And then you just fill in little details and play the world as it is. That's improv. D&D is improv. Like all this stuff is improv, and it's just been around for many, many years. And then all of a sudden, some people in the like 70s were like, you guys, we should do this on stage for like people and charge the money for it. And it was like, what? And now, you know, however many years later, 40 years later, we're doing it. And it's like a quote unquote legit art form that like people are like, I understand how that is worth it. Now, were the first improv shows that nobody went to in Chicago or London good? Yeah, sure. Maybe they were. Maybe they weren't. Who knows? Who cares? Yeah. It's not about that, right? It's about this creation of art, this grabbing of an idea, this like reinvention of how do I make stuff up and like let it live and then let it go, you know? But we are part of like a long tradition of people, and we're just on this section of the wave. Like, you know, so it's interesting to see how our part as artists is really just to find the art that makes us most able to communicate where we're at in our lives and then just go for that.
Yep. So, you know, you talked about how improv existed probably way before somebody told, oh, this is cool. This is improv, right? Yeah. That reminds me of my cousin who, when we were kids, he's 4 years older to us. And what he used to do is he used to make up these stories to tell us younger cousins during bedtime. He used to start with a very random fact, like we took a bus ride today. And then he started with, oh, we took a bus ride today. So we went from this part to this part. And then in the middle, there was a dragon that came. And then we had to fight the dragon. In the middle, there were these, you know, weird forests that we had to go through. And then he used to make the stories up on the spot. But it was so good to us kids looking at him. I was like, he knew that story beforehand. He had probably memorized, but then, you know, he was making it up because I knew he was making it up because he was taking personal details from each of our lives, which made it so much more special. I didn't know what improv was then. I wouldn't know about it until, you know, whose line is it anyway, years later.
Right.
But that was what he was doing. And I think the art of just in the moment, making something of meaning and then only to let it go and then let it sort of disappear is so fascinating to me, because that is that one moment, and then it's not going to repeat again. It's not going to happen again. Something else is going to happen. So I think that's, for me, magical. That's what's magical about improv for me, regardless of the different styles and the different methodologies to it.
Yes.
We are all doing that. We're creating magic, and then we're poof, gone.
Yeah. Yeah, the power of letting it go at the end, the power of accepting that this beautiful moment that you're having is only here for us right now, and then it's gone, is amazing. There's so much in art where we're trying to hold on to it. We're trying to make sense of it. We're trying to, you know, like the idea of legacy and like, what will people remember me for? I hope they remember me for never doing the same thing twice. Like, you know, like the idea of that, there's also something deeply philosophical about embracing letting things go. You know, and getting into the mindset of like, even though this scene is maybe the best scene I've ever done in my life, it's only right now and it will never be again. And instead of being sad that like, oh, no, it's never going to be, it's like, no, man, it's so much better because of its tiny fleeting moment that it got. And then like a little firefly just went away. You know, So cool. Absolutely. So tell me more about your current community in improv and theater. You mentioned, you know, not just do improv, you're also doing poetry readings, you're writing, you're doing storytelling nights I've seen on your Facebook. So like what's your community like? What's your vibe right now?
Ooh, okay. So I belong to a few, in terms of theater, in terms of art, I belong to a few sort of groups right now. So I'm part of, there's a thriving improv community in India and in Bangalore. I belong to a group called Improv Comedy Bangalore in Bangalore. That's the name. Mm-hmm. And apart from that, I also perform playback theater, which is basically, it is improvised theater, but the fundamental difference is that we play back stories, personal stories and real experiences of the audience. So in terms of practice, it is different in terms of what is required, etc. That is a beautiful form of theater. There is a company called City Lamps that I'm part of.
Oh, great.
And apart from that, of course, I perform poetry. I did not know that there was a thing called spoken word poetry, to be honest.
Oh yeah.
I wrote something and I performed it. I was having the paper in my hand, but I knew it. So I was just like trying to engage with the audience, and then somebody came to me, and this was in 2017. Somebody came to me and was like, "You do spoken word." I was like, okay, that's what I do.
Yes, I do.
That's how I learned about spoken word. And yes, I do take part in storytelling events. Sometimes, not as often as I would like to. Even poetry, I think ever since the pandemic started, it has been a little difficult for me to engage online in poetry spaces. Though theater, I took to online theater like that. I loved it. I love it even now. Somehow poetry did not really happen. And I didn't force myself. I think I'm just waiting it out. It'll come back. And I'll be able to sort of create and engage in poetry again. But I'm okay with it. It's okay. It goes and comes and goes, ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying theater. And the pandemic has been a lot of things, but it has also been, I think, a great opportunity for, I think, improvisers and playbackers from all over the world to just engage in all the joy that has been created and just connect with people all over the world, and as I think we were discussing beforehand, just find community, you become best friends with these people from miles and thousands of miles away, and I think that has been fantastic.
It's made the world feel so small. Like I used to be like, Oh, like classic American. Like, I'm like, oh, there are other countries? I didn't know. I was, what? But now, like, I feel, like, comfortable, like, legit looking at a map of every continent and being like, yeah, I think I got a friend on everyone. Yeah, yeah. We're good. You know, I'm solidly doing this. Like, even when I'm preparing and trying to find new guests, I'm like, oh, I've only talked to a couple people in New Zealand. So, yeah, let's check it out. Who's got this? You know, what's the cool thing going on down there? Right. It's really made it feel so much easier to do. Like, you know, talk to me 5 years ago. And if you were like, yeah, you're going to have a long conversation with a girl in India, I'm like, OK, I'm sure I will. Yeah. I'm definitely going to do that. And it's like, now I feel like, you know, you mentioned improv comedy Bangalore and I'm like, oh yeah, totally. I know it. Yeah. I can't wait to go someday. Like totally cannot wait till the day when I can like show up and be like, ICB, what's up? Like, great. Like, such a good community. I've talked to so many different people there. Like, oh, yeah. It's just like a good group. It seems like to take care of one another and like just continue to come up with new ideas, you know, and like idea generating, creativity generating. Like, there's something so great about having a community that isn't just like, I don't know if you know how cool we are, like, check out our shows. But, like, there's also a whole element of the ICB community that's like, hey, here's, like, a random line to inspire us to all write jokes. Let's write jokes now. Go. And then, like, everyone's like, oh, okay, I got one. Let's do this. And it's, like, people all over the world. And you're like, oh, good one. Excellent zinger. And it's like, am I having a conversation with a guy in Indonesia right now? Like, are we, like, laughing about how his comment is about the office? Like, what? You know, so it's just like made the world seem so small, made it seem like we can do theater and like really connect. And yeah, I mean, theater is a beautiful thing, you know, as far as allowing people to play different characters. And my favorite part about improvised theater is just that the people who are trained in improv and trained in the idea of creating something and letting it go are so much more willing to take big chances and create big ideas. And even if they don't work on stage, they always inspire someone else. And that sometimes is all you need. If you can inspire another person, you know what I mean? I was talking the other day about, you know, I told some story about another interview that I had had, and they were like, oh, I think I heard her talking about that on a different podcast. And I was all like, you're telling me that a person told a story about me on a different podcast? Like, just the idea of, even if they didn't talk about me, but they talked about the experience and they didn't say my name, it's not even about that. It's just about the experience we had stayed in their brain and then it came out in another art form. Like, yes, that's all I want. Like, I don't need my name to be known ever, but I love the idea that I could inspire somebody to do something that after a conversation they have with me or they hear that I have, they could be inspired to create something. That is just the best. And it's so much of what I would like to do. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I think it's the whole concept of like bringing a brick and not the castle, which we do it in improv, you know, bring a small thing and then trust that somebody else is going to bring another small thing and then it's going to become this big thing, which is wondrous. I think even in life, I've seen a lot of improvisers. First of all, improvisers are the most like the best cheerleaders. I just feel like, you know, if I bring a small idea that I'm not sure about and then I put it in the community, everybody's going to be like, oh, that is so good. And you can do this with that. You can, you know, and then everybody just brings a small element to it. And then, you know, there's a whole structure there. And I think that is one of the best things about improv. Of course, there's the stage, there's the performances that we do, that there's the thing that we, that's the main thing. But I feel like it so translates to our personal lives that in the best way. So yeah, the community, I think every 10 days or so, I just send a silent thanks to Siddharth and Shreya, who basically create those little games. Yeah. Because I'm like, oh my God, this is so much fun. And this is a great way for people to, you know, meet each other and connect with each other without the overtly connecting, you know, hey, hi, I'm Shweta, I'm from Bangalore, which can sometimes feel a little off.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh God.
Yeah, that's why the best group on the internet is improvisers talking about food, because we all are aware that there's a base knowledge that we have of theater, of improv, but we don't talk about it. We talk about something else. And that slight deviation from topic makes everyone just feel more comfortable. Like sometimes when I'm reading these comments and I'm like making funny comments back, I like don't know who I'm talking to. And then I click on them and I'm like, oh my God, they run a theater in like Germany, are you kidding me right now? Like, I'm talking to the top guy in the, you know, and he's just like, yeah, you know, you should put basil in that, you know, and I'm just like dealing with him in a real, like, just, oh, you're right. Okay. I'm going to put more basil in this. Right. And it's like, who am I getting this tip from? Oh, I see. He runs 47 theaters. He's been doing theater since he was 2. Oh my God. You know, like, you know, you just don't know. And the beauty is just being friends and connecting. And you're right. There is something so like supportive and like cheerleader about improv. There's no ego. There's no competition. We don't have to one up each other. I mean, we do, but usually with bits, you know, less with like, I'm actually way better at creating characters than you. So,
yeah.
Oh. Man.
I think it's one-upping with the intention of making the other person look good. Mm-hmm. So it's still within that sort of a structure, the one-upping that we do. But yeah, improvisers talking about food is one of the best groups, if not the best group ever.
Yeah, I mean, I like legitimately am concerned that Facebook is going to be shut down because I'm like, okay, how can I get that group somewhere else? Can we do improvisers talking about food on Clubhouse or you know, can I get a Slack channel that's just this? I need to talk to my people to the point where sometimes I can't even cook without like, look, and I'm like, what's for dinner? I don't know. Let's see what they're cooking. I'm like, oh, cheese tray. Okay, I can do that. Yeah. You know, it's like, that's the hardest part about being like the mom in a family. I'm doing 1,000 things. And then all of a sudden they're like, what's for dinner? And I was like, oh, I don't know. That being said, I just wanted to thank you. Speaking of food, thank you for sharing with me like a whole series of like chutneys, because now I am like getting better and better at chutneys. I'm like trying different herbs and putting them together and like looking up recipes and stuff in ways that like flavor combinations that I've never thought of in my whole life. And I love that, you know, different cultural food choices can inspire. Like, it's like, I've never made a chutney in my life. And then all of a sudden you were like, here's a recipe. And I was like, making that right now. I mean, like, I have one in my fridge right now waiting for lunch because I was like, oh, you're going to talk to Shweta and then you're going to do this and have the most delicious food and be all like, I loved talking to her and I loved her advice on food. Ow. Like,
oh, I'm so glad. Yes.
It's just like opened my mind. And like, I love that we have different, and sometimes I look at our different like recipes and I'm like, oh, I wonder why they use this, you know, vegetable more than that one. Yeah. And I'm like, it's legitimately just farming. It's like the land. And, you know, like, what was it? I watched somebody the other day was talking about how, it was somebody in India, I believe, where they were like, oh, we make these fried potatoes for special occasions. And I was like, I eat fried potatoes every day. And that's just because I've just got an abundance of potatoes. And it's possible that wherever the potato was in this country, it was like, well, we don't have them so often, so they're special. And I was like,
yeah.
Dude, amazing. Like, just even the idea of that, like, of abundance and scarcity when it comes to both food and sort of creativity and recipes, like, I love it.
We We learned so much from that group, I have to say, legitimately. Speaking of, so when you told me that you learned the chutney recipe from me, I was just thinking that if my mother hears this podcast, she is going to laugh until, like, she's going to laugh and laugh forever. Because my mother and I have some differences when it comes to cooking and how we view cooking.
Sure.
And in the kitchen, I improvise a lot. I like to make certain dishes and I make them well, but everything else I am blissfully in ignorance of. And my mother's like, this girl does not know how to cook. Because for my mother, knowing how to cook means you know how to cook the daily, like, you know, the Indian, the traditional, you know, you should know how to make all of that.
Yeah.
Dosa, all of that, right? I don't know how to make all of it. I know how to make some chutneys, and some other chutneys I can look at a recipe and make it.
Yeah.
But then my mother, because I think also years of preparing food and years of learning, she can make so many things so well. So, so well. So sometimes I have to remind her that, Mom, you are comparing me to you, and that is not fair.
Yeah.
That's I'm here. You are all the way over there, and you're amazing.
Yeah. I mean, okay, to her point, clearly she's probably amazing, and I would love to eat her food at some point. But, like, I started out as a terrible cook. Like, my mother taught me how to order food out at a restaurant. Like, there was not, like, lessons or, like, we ate very well. Like, I was like, what, you guys had chicken every single night your whole life? Oh, no? Oh. You know, like, my parents were not, my dad had, like, two dishes he did really well. That was about it, right? They did not cook very well. They didn't teach us how to cook at all. They were working too much. Like, so when I became an adult, I just had to start, thank God for the internet, I started Googling just different things. I was like, well, what do I have in here? Now they have websites where you can put a list of all the things you get in your fridge, and it's like, here are recipes you can make. And I'm like, hooray. But the other thing too, with us connecting internationally on recipes, is that there are also, like, spices and ingredients that just aren't available here. You know what I mean? Or, like, I have to order, like, a certain spice and I have to get it internationally and it takes 3 weeks to come. And I'm like, oh, in 3 weeks, I'm going to make this amazing curry. But right now, the only thing I have is this thing that's called curry powder. And it's like, but what kind? Doesn't matter. We just have one. It's just one flavor. And it's called curry. And that's what America does. You're like, here you go. You can do it. And I was like, I'm pretty sure there's more than one flavor, but okay, I'm going to do this. You know, it just different things. Like, I would never think of putting certain spices together. And then I'm reading these recipes and I'm like, oh, okay. Or I have to search what's a good sub for this thing. Cause it's like, how do I find that? Or, like, there's a vegetable that, like, I'll never find in my life, you know? It's fascinating to be an improvised cook, you know? No shade to your mom. I'm sure she's great. But you creating things from your mind, I think that's amazing. I am a slave to the recipe. Like, I can't get away from it. So I have to. And maybe someday after I get a little bit better, because I'm working on it, I can lean into improv, which is, I guess, kind of my own theatrical journey, too. I started with written plays. I would do other people's plays. And then I eventually, in my 30s, got into improv. Because I, like you, didn't find improv until I was older, which, again, I really just think is the best. You know, I loved finding it in my 30s because it definitely took a weight off my shoulders about, like, you have to do these plays. Because I was in a very, like regular, like, play theater, like, doing plays, especially here, there's a lot of, like, high, you know, they think that they're very fancy. They're all like, oh, well, you can do plays at these theaters. But if you do it at these small ones, they're no good. And I'm like, I paid for the rights to this play and I'm putting it on. I'm sorry you don't think mine is good and yours is better, but, you know, budget amounts notwithstanding, I think it was pretty good. It was all right kind of play. But there's this like snobbery. But in improv, it's just like egalitarian. Like everyone can do it. You're making it up. It's just about your imagination. There's something beautiful about it. And now we're discussing like internationally, and we can make friends and do improv across the world. And we have a shorthand that we understand, even though a lot of cultural things are different in our lives. But we have this shorthand of improv that we can then connect with. Yeah. So connect it's so with. Great.
Yeah. It's so interesting, though, that you started out with scripted plays and then went to improv. For me, I jumped into my first theater course that I took. I literally, so the way that I came about it is I thought, oh, I should learn theater. I should really push myself to do it. So I Googled basic theater course for beginners or something of that sort. And I legit just went to the first link that I could find. And that's me. Like what I do is when I want to watch a movie, I don't generally look at the reviews. I just go. And then if it turns out to be really bad, that's okay. Because I don't know, I somehow have a hesitation to look at reviews that way. There are certain things I do my research on, like, for example, if I have to buy a laptop, etc. But sure. With this, I just jumped in. And only when I enrolled and I attended like the first day, did I come to know that it is it's, you know, playback theater. It's unscripted theater. And I did not know that such a beast existed. You know, in my mind, theater was that you are given dialogues and then you go up on stage and say those dialogues. But I think looking back, it was such a wonderful coincidence, because I think going on stage and not having any idea what you want to say, that means it has to come from inside, you know, and that's what I started with. So my journey has been from improv playback to a certain extent. I worked on device productions, which was not necessarily improvised, but also sort of the process is improvised, and to scripted to a certain extent. That has been my journey in a way, which is why it's so interesting that, you know, even as learning to cook, I just throw something in and make something. But now I'm mindfully paying attention to having a recipe and following that recipe and, you know, really holding myself back from the urge to just throw some random thing in, deviating from that recipe. So I think all our parts are so fantastic in their own way. I love that.
Yeah. I also love the idea that we have a hand in creating the full experience of it. Like when you do a scripted play, somebody else wrote it, you're trying to figure out what they meant, what their point of view was, the way they want the characters to speak. Sometimes it's set in a specific time period. You have to like figure out what they were like during that time period, and so that you can honor whatever this writer meant, right? But when you're just creating it in that moment, like the power of that and knowing that you can do it, I think is so powerful to an artist, to empower them to know like you have it inside you and you can do this. You don't need somebody else's words. You don't need a director to tell you this is how you feel. You know, and you can trust that about yourself.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, man. Awesome. So I want to ask you one final question. Thank you so much for sharing your evening with me. I really appreciate you. So tell me, what is it that you are doing to fill your creative cup? What is it that is making you inspired? What is it that you're taking in? Are you reading books? Are you, you know, watching movies? Are you knitting? You know, what is it that fills up the ideas so that when you go into improv class, you've got a bunch of possibilities to put out there?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So I have my bursts of like, there are days when I'm just like, get things done, meet 100 people, not 100, but like a lot of people, socialize. And then I inevitably hit a sort of a wall. And then I'm like, I don't want to see another human being for a while, you know? And I think I've learned to sort of finally embrace that rather than fight it. So what fills me up on some days would be solitude, just being by myself. And I make it a point to spend at least 10 minutes a day. Sometimes it's more, but 10 minutes a day just sitting by myself. I don't call that meditation. I feel like meditation has become such a loaded word now. So I wouldn't necessarily call it meditation, but I just sit by myself, you know, and that fills me up on some days. But some days it is just reaching out to a friend, having a long conversation. I do love long conversations like this. So having a long conversation with someone. Some days what fills me up is the improv rehearsal. You know, I'm part of an all-women's improv group called the Adam and Eves. And when we used to rehearse, it used to be magical in the sense that because we were also, I think, you know, close to each other, we're also sort of Indian women having a lot of the similar experiences, a lot of similar trains of thoughts and beliefs. Our rehearsals used to sort of, our rehearsals were these whirlwinds of creativity that would leave us all energized. And I love that about those moments. So I think it depends on where I'm at any given point of time. Some days it would be outward that I gain my sort of creativity from. Some days it would be inward, so writing and sitting by myself, daydreaming. I do a lot of daydreaming. I think it is a very important thing that everybody needs to learn to do and just do more of it. So So these are things that I like to do. One thing that I do believe is that whatever you do, I feel like there has to be joy in it. Because otherwise, what's the point? I mean, I understand the requirements of life. You know, sometimes we might do something for the money, or sometimes we might do something because of the approval of somebody whom we love. And I do that too. But by and large, I feel like there has to be joy. That is the juice. And that sort of sometimes just, that is enough to keep me going, you know?
Yeah.
So the best creations, I feel, come out of joy and not sort of, I feel the old adage of like, you know, you need to struggle and that's how from the pain you get amazing things. I feel like that is not always true. I feel like a lot of times joy can give you some beautiful things that you can create as well.
Yeah. No, I think that struggling artist thing is just from the same culture that tells us artists aren't worth anything. Like they're like, yeah, you know, the only way you're going to make it is if you like really struggle and you have like the hardest time, or like, oh, what's that? You don't have depression. Well, you'll never be able to make art. It's like, okay, gosh, like, how about it doesn't all have to be so sad all the time? Like, and don't get me wrong, some of the happiest people in the world that I know write the darkest stuff, you know, like their stories that come out of them because they're so happy. They're like, what do I do with these weird negative thoughts? Oh, I'll write a horror book. Like, and then you're like, great, look at you. You got it all out. And it's spooky. I like it. Right. But it's like, they're just trying to be themselves and, you know, enjoy the experience of being creative. And, you know, I feel like, weirdly, if I've noticed anything about people, it's that they have a tendency to try to take away joy from other people. You know, people like to bring people down, you know, like there's a whole celebrity worship thing. And instead of being like, wow, you were so great in that movie, you're so awesome. Like on the internet, for instance, it's like, why she got to be so ugly? And you're like, what does that have to do with the movie? I was like, she's a vampire. Like, what do you think is going to happen? Like, She gotta look a little rough. She fighting people every 3 seconds. Like, you know, what? Why are you putting that negativity out in the world? But it's like a lot of people, you know, they don't have the capacity for joy. And sometimes I think like what we were talking about earlier, like being able to tap into that childlike ability to create stories, to honor your own stories, and to know that like daydreaming, for instance, that was a great note. Like, you should be daydreaming. Yeah, absolutely. You should let your mind wander. Imagine 1,000 possibilities, you know, in recovery groups, they call it play the tape. Like, meaning like you are thinking, I want to do this bad. Like, I don't drink anymore. I want to drink. Cool. Imagine, let's daydream for a moment. What would happen if you did, you know, then you get to play the tape all the way to the end. And then you're like, oh no, that's not good at all. I should not do that. It ended terribly in my daydream. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. But it helps us reflect on what could happen, what has happened in the past, or alternately, a way to like reframe things where you're like, well, I've gone on 47 dates and they didn't go well, but 48, now this one's going to go great, you know, and you can just imagine a new one. You're like, yeah. And then he's going to be like, I love the way your hair is messy. Yes, it is. Thank you. You know, things like that. You know, if you don't allow your brain to come up with to daydream all the possibilities, like, you know, how are you ever really going to know what possible, you know, things could happen in your life? You could be missing so many opportunities because you're not opening your brain to it.
Yeah, that is so true.
Shweta, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been a great chat with you. I'm so happy that we got to meet and talk finally. Like, in person on Zoom, but you know, like talking to each other's faces as opposed to online, which we've done a bunch of times. Yeah. But like, it's great to connect with you, and it's been a wonderful conversation. So thank you so much for sharing your stories with the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I love the conversation that we had. I am taking away a few points for, you know, as a note to myself. And I loved it. Thank you.
Great.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.